First case in our calendar is 96-2095, Joyce Van Wyker versus Motors Mutual Insurance Company, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you, Justice Watkins. I'm Robert Rogers, I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Joyce Van Wyker.
Did your client have notice that there was an opening of an estate?
No, Your Honor.
Why would they have not had notice? Why would they? She had not have had notice. She knew of the death.
She knew of the death. Her niece, the daughter of her brother, was appointed administrator, and counsel was not this client for that administrator. It's opening the estate, never notified other potential wrongful death beneficiaries of the estate, to include their names on the list.
Was there a will?
Not that I'm aware of.
Would she have been entitled to inherit under the statute of descent and distribution?
No, that's why she's not.
So there would be no notification because there was a surviving spouse and or children?
Certainly are.
So she never had any notice, not only of the opening of the estate, the naming of fiduciary, but clearly no notice of the settlement.
No notice of the settlement either.
I thought she thought about it, but decided not to hire a lawyer to pursue her claim.
The only thing that she never got any notice before she was heard about any official documents. She's gotten some sort of second-hand, offhand notice from her mother, which was the mother of the deceased, that there was, you know, some action going on regarding her brother, but was never given any indication by any court documents, or that she had any claim, or that any settlement was being made on her behalf.
Why didn't she appeal the denial by probate court to set aside the settlement?
Your Honor, at that point in time, it was 2 weeks before the 2 year statute of limitations was going to expire. If, in fact, the probate judge had been reversed on appeal, there would have been no way to sue the tortfeasor anyway. The 2 years had to run.
That's the reason she didn't appeal?
Well, yes, Your Honor. Besides which, it's the question is also before the probate, but I would say the statutory action that the legislature set on out is appropriate. And in fact, they have the authority, the probate judge has the authority to settle, even without the consent of these beneficiaries, even if they're, whether they're notified or not. So, yes, it's hard to say the probate judge's action was inappropriate. And that's really the problem we're talking about here, is the statutory scheme. Under this scheme, it really works on an issue of timing. I think timing is critical issue. Her vendor bought a motorist who kills her brother. That motorist had some substantial money, at least $250,000 available, and she had $100,000. Uninsured policy with the mutual. Maybe she didn't have a claim, maybe she didn't, maybe she will. She didn't become an uninsured motorist, and the power of the probate court said, you take nothing out of these proceeds. Well, the probate court had given her $100,000 of the proceeds, he wouldn't have been an uninsured motorist. The probate court had allocated her $50,000, he'd only been an uninsured motorist by $50,000, an underinsured. But when the probate judge allocated the $0, at that point in time, he became an uninsured motorist. At that point in time, she made her claim. Now, what's interesting about that timing is...
Well, wait, now let's stop there, because that's where we always get into the problems. He did not become an uninsured motorist at the moment of the payment of the full policy limits. He was an underinsured motorist.
Well, he was underinsured.
Okay. There's a difference.
Then, at that point in time, she knows that she can then make a claim because he's underinsured as her now. That determination under the statutory scheme isn't made until after the probate judge has approved the settlement release. So, I say this is analogous to that case of Crayley versus Vancouver. 2 years go by, the motorist's insurer becomes bankrupt, and now fined after it's too late. In fact, the motorist has been released by operation law. That the person is an uninsured motorist. That determination occurs after the person has been released by operation of law, whether it's by statute of limitations or by the probate judge's action. Then the determination comes in that the person is either uninsured or underinsured. And at that point in time, they still have a contract right. And that's what a number of the other different court of appeals has said when the statute of limitations appears. We have a contract action which goes for 15 years. If by operation of law, the right against the tortfeasor disappears, there still is a right to sue for the next 10, 13 years for your contract action. The way I understand subrogation, the insurer doesn't stand in any better shoes than the insured. And the insured, in this particular case, loses her right without her consent because the probate judge grants his release to pursue the person. But then, why should the insurer have greater rights than the insured? I mean, if the insured can't object to it, then the insurer certainly shouldn't be able to either. And they still have that contract obligation.
This doesn't have anything to do with your case, and I understand that. I understand the issues in the case, so I'm not off on a tangent. How would you quantify in dollars the amount of your client's alleged damage?
We've done a number of wrongful death cases. The two judges sitting afterwards. And typically, we have judges because of the loss of society, companionship, of a brother, and the language. All of the things being equal, we typically have judges awarding either $50,000 to $100,000 for a loss of the sibling. That's happened in three cases that we've handled. So, it's a hard to quantify proposition.
Okay. Well, you can see it's hard to quantify, and we all we do is pick a figure. Because really, would I have any damage for the loss of a sister in a wrongful death action in California, especially if I am estranged from her?
Not necessarily. No. In this particular case, they were very close. His brother helped build their house, do a bunch of other different types of roofing, so very close relationship. And I'm certain in this particular case that I would have done $100,000. Typically, the one way you can arrive at that figure is, I think, the jury verdict report was that they were having a wrongful death verdict in Ohio, somewhere around $530,000. If you consider that there's, you know, a typical family where there's close relatives, number of children, spouse, and so forth, that you're going to be, at least, juries are figuring $100,000.
Okay, you can get back to your case now.
Well, the other point I'd like to discuss here is on the policy language itself in this particular case. And I'm not excited in my reply brief. So the person seeking the uninsured motorist coverage must also properly notify us of a tentative settlement between the insured and the insurer of the vehicle. Now, I put in a footnote here that the tentative settlement agreement of the administrator and the tort fees insurer was not an agreement between the insured and the tort fees insurer. So, she did violate the clause the way it's written in this particular case, or it certainly would be ambiguous to that extent. To the fact that she has this person, they say, well, she is the administrator, the beneficiary representative. Certainly. But the administrator cannot release the tortfeasor by herself without completing the probate. So it's the probate court that is doing this release, not, in effect, her or her representative.
Is all we're looking for in these cases a perfunctory objection to the filing or the approval of the probate settlement? For instance, what if she had retained counsel and counsel had gone to the probate court and said, we object to the settlement? Probate court's going to approve it anyway in most cases if it's the policy limits. And what happens? Now, does that prevent a malpractice or does it also preserve her rights?
That's the problem. All the claims together and the one jury verdict was taxed, the probate court has to divide them on out. You're going to get a larger settlement number than any individual uninsured claim. So if the insurance company has had this particular case decided that some number between $0 and $100,000, it still wouldn't have prevented the probate court from saying, gee, it's $250,000 settlement, it's all insurance proceeds, and it's proper to approve. There was no way to stop the practice in this case, and it doesn't work in this case. I don't think she should get stopped. Now, the other issue is, this issue is important for future cases because set contract rights go for 15 years. So for the next 11 years, even discounting Senate Bill 20 coming up in October 1994, you'll have all those pre-October 1994 cases for the next 11 years still coming up and being able to make claims and coming before this court. Some of them, just the statute of limitations will pass, they'll still be able to make claims. And in some of them, the administrator of the estate may have, with the probate court approval, done a release. So this issue is viable. It is important in the decision of this court.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Watkins.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice of the Supreme Court, Mr. Rogers. I'm Steve Watkins here on behalf of the Board of Mutual Insurance Company. I would like to address my own comments and Mr. Rogers' comments and court below, Court of Appeals found, held in this decision that the appellant had actual notice of the probate proceedings case settlement. She did testify about a settlement. I suspect, because I took her deposition, the impression I had was she knew the probate proceedings were going on. She considered consulting an attorney to ascertain what her rights were, and chose not to do that because she was under the impression there was no point in doing so, and she didn't want to spend money on that bill. I would like to draw a distinction here between a settlement and the distribution of the settlement proceeds to the probate court. First of all, under the statutory framework, I guess 21.503, the probate court the administrator can propose a settlement with the beneficiaries on behalf of the beneficiaries. But if there is no settlement and no agreement as to how the settlement proceeds are distributed, the probate court makes that determination.
Counsel, in this case, is there any evidence? The insurance company paid full policy limits of the insured. Is there any evidence that the tortfeasor had other assets that your client could have gone after had they not been settled?
There is no evidence that she did or she did not. Matter of fact, that was the appellant's, as I understand it, second proposition of law. Would have made any difference anyway because she did. I don't see any evidence of that. I can take a brief out and see that the brief in the court below, and it doesn't make any difference anyway under this court's decision in both, but specifically both versus the president said, it's a present right in and of itself, whether or not it can be made in the court.
Your policy does not give your client the right to stop the settlement.
If motorists knows about Mr. Rogers indicated his family was apparently close. She's testified, the appellant testified, she was close to her niece. She spoke to her weekly.
But we can't write a case for close families as opposed to non-close families. What if you had a situation where you had a second marriage and the decedent man had two children by the first marriage, and the second marriage the wife was estranged from the two children in another city, and suddenly there was a wrongful death? She goes, gets herself appointed fiduciary, and settles for the policy proceeds promptly, as we often do in these cases, or I did in the past. With no notice at all to the two children, even though they might have been close to their father. Any cause of action?
Cause of action on behalf of?
Of the two children, against their own underinsured coverage on the basis that the policy limits were paid to the surviving spouse without notification to the two children.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justice. I'm afraid that that's not on the list of potential questions. It would be nice if we could be able to watch it and get questions. I would suspect in that scenario that the children would clearly be next of kin, would be entitled to notification.
If they're in the jurisdiction, we always went through that business rule that we had to serve somebody outside the jurisdiction in a probate, especially if they wouldn't inherit under the statute of descent and distribution. And I can think of some other examples. The problem is, what if you have no notification?
No notification along with actual knowledge or reason to, I mean, children.
Okay.
I guess I'm going to have to confess it to some extent my ignorance, to a great extent my ignorance of probate procedures. Yes. The record in this case contains an interesting fact. As I mentioned, the child was close to her niece. She was also close to her mother. Her mother lived. And her mother, there is a probate distribution document that was attached to the most of the summary judgment of the trial court says that her mother, Georgia Fett, is not claiming any of the amounts of liability coverage because she, quote, has presented a claim through her uninsured carrier nationwide. This claim is currently pending. Had appellant in this case complied with the policy provisions required prompt notification, let motorists know that these things are going on. Motorists, as her mother did, could have come into probate, objected to the release of the tortfeasor. It may well be that the probate court would say, in the event motorists decide to advance the money and protect its rights, well, I don't care where the money's coming from, that's fine. We'll just distribute these proceeds and go ahead and chase the tortfeasor. They may do that. They may do what the court is suggesting and counsel is suggesting here. One thing they can also do, motorists could require, in the terms of the policy, the appellant to go ahead as next of kin and present her claim to the probate court and consist and ask, request that she be awarded a share of this distribution. And in that event, they would have been entitled to set off those proceeds. Because none of the policy conditions that I cited in the brief were complied with, that right is gone, along with the right of subrogation, and the right of settlement.
In this case, the family survivors were. The family survivors were the relationships.
The appellant was the sister of the deceased. There were two minor children. There was a mother, brother, and there was a mother. I believe that. I'm not sure.
So there were minor children.
Yes.
And in your experience in these matters where there are minor children, any of the proceeds go to adult brothers and sisters who are not being supported by the central agency, such as this one?
I don't frankly have much experience in that.
history.
You can see your senses ordinarily zero history in the son that adults brother or sister is not to being supported by or cared by the deceased. We had one that's minor children. There may be some other circumstances where parents have are in need of economic support or
responding.
The family members may be in need of a substantial amount of state, but that's not the case. I would suspect that the majority of cases are just as well. The appellant's first proposition of law concerns, as referenced in the brief, the possibility. Is it possible for her to perform her obligation under the contract? For that reason, her performance should be excused. In essence, she's saying, it's not my fault. On behalf of the motorist, I question the defendant with the record. But she said, it may be her fault, but in any event, it wasn't the motorist's fault. We're being asked here to pay the price for what this seems to be. Difficulty with the statutory framework and these types of cases between the wrongful death statute and the mature legislation. The impossibility doctrine is interesting. It's clear, it's admitted, acknowledged, it's basic. This is a contract principles we require, despite the fact there are stages that affect it. Now, one of the contract principles that they've raised is impossibility of performance, and the law, as I understand it, on that subject, is that impossibility of performance occurs where after the contract is entered into, an unforeseen event arises rendering impossible the performance of one of the contracting parties. However, the contracting party will not be excused from performance merely because the performance may prove difficult. I will submit that in the event that contractual doctrine applies at all in this case, the way she would argue because it was merely difficult. Impossible. She knew the probate proceedings were going on. She could have done what she actually did in this case earlier. After she hired an attorney, they went to the probate court and they objected to the release of the court. Filed a motion to vacate the settlement. This is before us, and we noticed the notice of the fact that it happened before this. In that motion, she says she has to present her claim to her UM carrier prior to the settlement release, which may compare their UM claim. On July 5th of 1995, also before notice to all this, the accident claim, her attorney states it's unfair to have her lose the right to sue the tort fees without notice, when that will cause them to lose their insurance coverage. That's what she has said in the house. And had she done that earlier in a timely fashion, she would have complied with the policy provisions or at least prevented the prejudice that ensued. Counsel has made reference to statute of limitations. This is not a statute of limitations case. I have suggested in brief, he suggests in brief, and apparently here, this court ought to adopt what at least I perceive to be a screening change, which is I suggest that that's not warranted by the facts of this case, and that this court should refrain from doing so. It is an invitation to judicially legislate. The legislature can address this problem, to the extent they haven't already done so. They can address this problem. This crystal ball is a little bit clearer than mine in terms of what's going to happen. There are cases that the counsel has cited where similar but not identical facts have occurred. In all of them, the insurer was notified first before the settlement in the case of the Wendy Way. Jarvis, there's more than $45 from the fraud.
But when do you feel was the last possible time that she could have notified you and preserved her rights? After what point did she lose all those rights that you protected her from?
The cases that I've seen and I tend to agree with indicate 2 to 3 months before the settlement, with an ample time for the insurer to get on notice, get an attorney, intervene in
two or three months before the settlement. If she had called you a week before and said, I just found out about a settlement, it's going to go in next Monday, I want to give you notice about this and comply with the requirement that I give you notice, that wouldn't be sufficient?
Because arguably it would.
Well, why did you pick 3 months then?
Because that's what the case of Jarvis said.
But that's not exactly the end-all or be-all. It's a notice before some activity took place that would cut off your rights. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. I guess perhaps I also feel that period of time is reasonable because being in the business, I tend to know how things work and how much time things take. But you are right. A week before, it is possible to be insured that this works.
If she knew about it.
If she
knew. Where in this case, they claim they didn't know about it.
Motors did not know about it. So, 10 months after the
settlement had come through. Okay.
Now, this court has said before, unanimously, for a period of decision in York versus State Farm, that the uninsured motor statute 3937.18 was not intended to provide coverage in every uncompensated situation. Now, you've got to go back some, that was 1980. You've got to go back some to find human liberty. That principle was reiterated by Farmers Insurance Company in 1991. In 1990, in State Farm versus Webb, this court said there was no UM claim when a tortfeasor had a federal employee's pension liability, which has since been changed by statute. The courts have quoted this, of course, language in current extensively. A contrary result would deprive the appellant of a major provision of its policy and its subrogation rights. Such a holding requiring the appellant to pay underinsured benefits to appellee in this circumstance for appellant to have no subrogation rights against the court region would contravene the intent of the underlying statute and deprive appellant of rights for which it contracted. We submit that is K2. For all the reasons that I've mentioned, I respectfully request that the judgments of the court below be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. Mr. Rogers, you stayed about 3 minutes of your time.
Mr. Rogers, the Court of Appeals opinion makes a couple of specific findings. One, that your client was aware of the opening of the estate, but was not made a party. That may or may not be important. The one I'm concerned about is, appellant had actual notice of the proceeding and the proposed settlement. What's in the record to support that, and why do you say that that's not so?
Okay, well, let me specifically address exactly what I'm talking about. So, Mr. Watkins said that the one that her mother lived with her, and that is not correct. Joyce did not live with her mother. She did not have contact with the niece, with the administrators. The niece, the administrators, nowhere in the record, either formally or informally, told her, I'm representing you, we have, or he never said that. One, I'm representing you, so we've got a claim. Or number two, that I'm assigned a release on your behalf, or that there's a settlement in the works. That is not there.
Well, then, the Court of Appeals is just absolutely wrong, then, you're saying.
What they did was during deposition, they said, well, you had to talk to your mother, you know that the niece was appointed as a probate action, yes, I knew that there was some probate action going on.
This says she had actual notice of the settlement, of the proposed settlement.
She did not.
So if we find that in the record, that we can determine that, you're willing to accept that you're done.
Well, yeah, actually, right, I would also say that this is the second problem. It's not in the record. You won't find it there. But the second point is, she has no control over this statute. And I'm just talking about all the cases. Not just this case, but no notice. but in every case.
She doesn't have to have control over the settlement to put,
put
in her objection. Objection is a simple 102 form or whatever it is that you just put in.
Better yet, the only thing the policy requires is for her to notify the insurer.
Correct.
It doesn't say she has to control the probate, does it?
The settlement agreement between the insurer and the insurer. And there was no settlement agreement between the insurer and the insurer of the vehicle. There was no tentative settlement agreement. Because she did not enter into a settlement agreement with that insurer under the statutory scheme. The administrator did, and the probate court approved it. She didn't have any control of that. She did not violate that policy. Even the language of that policy says between the insured and the insured vehicle. She didn't sign any such agreement. So I think regardless of on this specific policy language, she didn't violate that policy language the way it's written as well. Her deposition is part of the record. I think the court should review that deposition. You will find that she has no actual notice of the settlement.
Mr. Rogers, the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.